I don't think you can have industry growth without personal growth.
This is Growth in Dentistry, a dental intelligence podcast, where we ask the question, what does growth in dentistry mean to you? I'm Steve Jensen, a data dental nerd and your host.
Welcome, everyone. I am super excited about today's episode. Now, before we jump in, I want to give a huge shout out to the Dental Intelligence Marketing team for putting this on week after week after week. It's a lot of work to run a podcast. If you didn't know, a lot happens behind the scenes. One other thing, every week they have a great offer for those that are new listeners, for those that are old listeners. If you haven't checked out Dental Intel recently, they have an offer for $50 to just come and do a demo. Go to get.dentalintel.net/podcast and you can get that offer. Lots of cool new things that we've released. We've got customized dashboards in a scorecard format. There's visualizations that just got thrown into there with nearly every single metric that you could imagine. So really cool stuff that we're releasing. Come and check it out if it's been a while, and I think you'll be pleasantly surprised. Now, without any further ado, let's go ahead and get to the podcast today. Today, I have a special guest, John Harris. He is a managing partner at Fortune Management. He is not new in the dental scene. He's been doing this for over 20 years. He said this is an old school thing. I'm going to mention it anyway because I think it's cool. I got my master's in business administration, had several operations classes, and there's a designation under Lean Six Sigma called a black belt. Now, he said he hasn't kept this up, but it's still impressive to me. And he got his black belt in Lean Six Sigma, which is really impressive to me. He brings a depth of knowledge and meaning and experience into dentistry that I think is really unique. So, John, I'm super excited to have you on today. Let's talk, John. Tell us, how did you even get into dentistry? Maybe let's start there. And then I want to jump in a little bit, like what you're seeing in dentistry. Let's kind of riff on status quo.
It's a great question. It was kind of intentional and kind of accidental at the same time. I had fallen into a successful career with FedEx. I was with them for a little over a decade, various levels of management there, and was essentially progressing through, you know, the management structure there. I had big aspirations of rising to the top, climbing the ladder, all that stuff. And my sister, who is my business partner, and I have always been very close, and she, well, I would come home from college, from work on the weekends, and I would hang out with her, and she and I would always discuss like really interesting books. And we were discussing a book called Power Versus Force by David Hawkins. Okay. He's a PhD and an MD. It was about kinesthesiological testing and how, you know, certain types of music, you know, cause your strength to go up and down. And got a lot into physics and metaphysics. Mm-hmm. And like the energy that you project out in the world is the energy that you attract back to yourself. And it was interesting conversation. She always had, you know, very deep conversations. And while we were discussing that book, I asked her, so I was like, is this what you do for a living? And she was like, what are you talking about? And I'm like, you go around and you teach people about this stuff. And she was like, yeah, that's a big part of it. And I made a declaration in that moment without knowing what I was doing. I said, I have to do that. Mm-hmm. I said it with enthusiasm and passion, and little did I know I had just set in motion the series of events that would ultimately lead to me leaving FedEx, coming over to Fortune 10 years later. So there were plans for me to leave FedEx and come over to Fortune. And, you know, this is an entrepreneurial, business. We're 100% commission. It's eat what you kill. And I had some difficulty wrapping my mind around walking away from a comfortable salary to 100% commission. And so I failed to make that decision consciously. And then 10 years later, I guess God got tired of waiting on me. And he said, kid, this is what you said you wanted to do. So here you go. And he took the decision out of my hands. And here we are.
And that's a great story. I think as I listen to that choice to transition into like 100% commission situation, I think a lot of doctors that are listening, maybe you don't think about opening up a dental practice and running it yourself as a doctor as like 100% commission mm-hmm. situation, but that's basically what it is, right? Like if your business does well, you're going to be successful. If it doesn't, you're not. You're going to have to figure something else out. And yeah, just yesterday I met with a doctor. She's out of greater Chicago area. She graduated in May, super impressive. And she just bought a practice. So straight out of school, buys this practice. and really like gung-ho. And it was so fun to like feel her energy and excitement to get going in dentistry. So there's a lot of things going on in dentistry that I think are really, really exciting. There's some things that I think are different than people expected. One of those that I want to talk about first. So ADA always is publishing stuff about, you know, how many doctors are associated with groups. So I'll like call a few things out and maybe just comment on a few things that I've seen slowing down. So current status quo, the number of dentists, this isn't dental practice, this is just dentists. Number of dentists or percentage of dentists associated with anywhere from 2 to 100 plus location groups is, let me add these up, 10, 13, 2, 15, 24%. So 24% of dentists are associated with a group that's got, you know, two or more locations. And people have said like, man, by 2025, a couple years ago, so I've been in dentistry for like 6 years. And when I joined, people were saying, yeah, 10 years from now, like 70%, 60% of the market's going to be associated with a DSO or some variation of that model. And that's certainly not played out. We had a couple of big years right through COVID where a lot of money was coming into the space and a lot of transition volume was happening and a lot of sales to DSOs were happening. And in the last 18 months, maybe 2 years, but really 18 months, the capital markets have slowed down. I think people have felt that and seen that. Costs have increased. And the focus has shifted for a lot of these groups from acquisitions to making each individual practice financially healthy and making sure that the value of each individual piece of that group is meaningful. And I hope that that same shift is happening in the minds of private practice owners. Now, John, tell me a little bit about what you've been seeing. I mentioned this in the beginning, but I want to make sure if people, maybe I didn't mention it. John is part of two different groups that I want to highlight that I think will be just important to note so you understand some context for, you know, why we're going to talk about what we're going to talk about. John is a member of the National Alliance of Merger and Acquisition Advisors. So there's one. And two, he's also part of the National Association of Certified Valuators and Analysts. So you have probably more context than anybody else when it comes to practice valuations, transitions. It's kind of the Wild West in the broker world right now in dentistry. There's not tons of regulation and organization. So tell us a little bit about what you're seeing, John, in the dental world.
Yeah, I definitely agree with the 20% or a little over 20% allocated to some type of group, whether it be a smaller 2, 3, 5, 10 location group or 100 plus location group. I've seen estimates of that rising to 50% by 2030. And it may, you may find 50% of the market associated with a group like that by 2030, but I certainly don't think private equity will have penetrated the market to that extent by then. Like right now, if you drive down the road and you look at medical practices, any vertical of medical, 80% of those practices that you drive by are private equity funded. They're associated with a hospital administrator. Dentistry's 80-20 the other way. It's still 80% private and 20% private equity. I don't think private equity is going to have 50% of the market by 2030. I do think probably we're going to have 50% of the dental practices across the country associated with some group, but I think those groups are probably going to be privately owned, dentist-owned DPOs. You know, where you've gotten, you know, 15, 20 dentists have gotten together, you know, taken all their practices, joined them together and formed one bigger enterprise to give themselves access to economies of scale. I do think that we'll probably see something like that. But I don't think private equity, I don't think private equity has the interest to get that, to penetrate this market, this industry by that extent. And I don't think that they would be able to.
One of the things I'm interested to hear your thoughts on this. One of the things I've wondered if we'll see more of as well is increase the number of doctors we have in a single roof. So it's been pretty common in dentistry. Like the classic format is, you know, one doc, two hygiene, and an assistant and administrative team around them in an individual location. Do you think we'll see more folks starting to consolidate into, you know, larger clinics under one roof?
Definitely. We're seeing unprecedented consolidation right now. And I mean, it's not that it's just started happening, but it is definitely speeding up. And if you look at just industry trends, and this is true for any industry, not just the dental industry, but you look at any industry trend, there's, you have the growth phase, Then you have when the industry begins to mature and then it starts to decline. Well, as it's reaching maturity, that's where you see a lot of consolidation. Early on in the industry is where you see a lot of fragmentation. And this is where all the specialists in dentistry came from, right? Prosthodontists and endodontists and periodontists and oral surgeons and pediatric dentists. Well, now, I mean, how many prosthodontists do you see out there operating independently as a prosthodontist? Not very many, because technology is more or less, you know, made that particular vertical of the profession obsolete. And I don't say that to be derogatory or critical by any stretch. But when you just step back and you look through an executive lens at the industry as a whole, and that's what executives do. That's their role, is to assess industry trends, market trends, and position their organization on the front side of that trend so that they're taking a proactive approach to organizational development, not a reactive approach. And so you see that happening now. You see GPs starting to bring implants in, sleep. You've got guided endo, you know, same day crowns technology. Another thing that's happening too is just the rapid acceleration of technology. And I would say to some extent, or to a large extent, I think technology is making some forms of specialist education obsolete. And what I mean is, if I'm a general dentist, I can go out and pay $50,000 a CE and $80,000 for a CBCT. I've got $130,000 invested, and I can go place an implant with the same level of confidence as a periodontist. I don't need to go to school for 2 or 3 additional years or take a residency to be able to do that. And so where's my return on investment? Higher, the GP option. And so I'm not saying there's always going to be GPs that don't like blood. There's always going to be GPs that don't want to place implants. There's always going to be GPs that, you know, believe that a periodontist is better postured and positioned and educated to provide that service, right? And I don't have a dog in the fight. So I'm not saying that one's right or wrong. I'm just saying that when you look at the way the industry is trending, that's what's happening. And so you're definitely seeing a lot of consolidation. I think that the periodontal vertical, obviously you've got hygiene coaching programs out there that are teaching general dental practice hygienists how to become more advanced with their periotherapy. So you're seeing perio getting consolidated. General dentists are now doing osseous surgeries and placing implants and multi-unit implants and full arches. So perio is getting very consolidated. You've got technology now making it easier and more ergonomic for general dentists to do, and more efficient for general dentists to do endo. So I think you're going to see endo continue to get consolidated. So I think the way that specialist practice is going to look different in the next few years. I think you're going to see fewer and fewer brick and mortar endo practices and perio practices, and you're going to see more itinerant specialists. You're going to see a periodontist, you know, who rotates between 16 different GP practices. The GP practice builds their schedule. The periodontist shows up, sees patients, goes home, takes a check, no headache. Right. So I think you're going to see more of that. I don't know that you'll ever see the brick and mortar option go away. But I think the ones that have been very successful and have built very big, prominent, you know, prevailing enterprises in their community, those are going to be the ones that you're going to continue to see there. And the ones that, you know, just aren't quite in the same position when the market changes, there's only two, you've only got a couple of options, right? You can go after a niche market, you can divest, or you can expand, you know, so it really depends on what your strengths and weaknesses are, you know, what path you're on. But yeah, I mean, I think we're coming into the golden years of private practice dentistry. I just think the way that we facilitate the business aspect of private practice dentistry is going to look very different.
Yeah, I 100% agree. And I have been, and I need to go look. I mean, I'm sitting on like a mound of data. I should go look and see, like, how often am I seeing providers come in that aren't full-time, that are completing, you know, endo codes, perio codes, and some of these specialist things. I could probably go just find out with 10,000 practices, like, what are some of the trends? My gut reaction is that I'm seeing more and more general practices bring them in, just like you're suggesting. Now, there's a lot of different ways we can approach patient care and profitability. And I want to make sure I frame this next conversation in the right way. You know, some people are worried about making practice ownership all about money, but the reality is that the better patient care that we give, the better we are at patient retention, the better we are at getting case acceptance to the stuff that we're diagnosing, the better profitable we're going to be. So I want to talk a little bit, John, about, you know, there's the strategy changes as markets changes, as consumers evolve, as our patients evolve, the strategy that we approach the business has to change. And one thing, though, that I'm not sure really changes a ton is what the value of the business is, or like how we look at it. I think there's some like tried and true ways that we can look at it, some bread and butter. And you're in that mix all the time, talking with doctors looking to make a transition. I think, if I understand right, John, both on the broker and the buyer side, is that right?
I'm just on the buyer side. Yeah.
So just on the buyer side.
When I do valuations, I'm doing an independent third-party valuation to validate the price that's been placed on the practice and help my buyer with, you know, calculating and projecting synergies and what's going to happen after the transaction.
Yeah, right? That's great.
But I'm strictly on the buyer side.
Okay, cool. That's helpful. And I actually like that you're not on the seller side. You don't have that same like that same connection with the seller. Like, hey, how can we like make this thing look like it's as worth as much as possible? You're coming in and saying like, objectively, what is the real value of this thing? So yeah. For those that are listening, I think this is going to be relevant, whether you're buying, whether you're selling, you know, for a dentist fresh out of school, for a dentist that's been associate for a while, that's considering getting into buying your own practice, this will be helpful. John, I'd love to hear, or if you're maybe you're like in the middle of a career later in your career, and you're like, you know, I don't know if I want to keep managing the business, and I would like to bring on a team that can help me with that. Maybe you're going to partner with some other dentists, but want to understand, how do you look at the value of a practice? So can you talk us through that, John, like the bread and butter of practice valuations?
Yeah, there's the comment you made earlier about valuations being the wild west right now is 100% accurate. It is the typical formula for valuations that I see right now is we're pulling an arbitrary percentage out of thin air and applying it to either the previous 12 months trailing 12 months revenue, mm-hmm. Or some kind of a weighted average of the previous 3 years, right?
I think people have heard some of the classics like 70% of collections or some, yeah, you know, multiple of your EBITDA, if you're more familiar with, you know, that side of things, of looking at the cash that the business is generating. So talk through that.
I think that's you can do that. I mean, just, mm-hmm. I mean, obviously there are people doing that. I think that's a very dangerous way to value a practice. Mm-hmm. And the reason is
yeah, tell why. Yeah. Why is that dangerous?
If you and I both own a practice, we're across the street from one another, we're both collecting $1 million. Mm-hmm. Okay. I'm fee for service, right? I'm doing implants, endo, ortho, oral surgery, IV sedation, full arches, and I'm dropping 55 points to the bottom line. Mm-hmm. You're inundated with Delta, so you're writing off 55% of every dollar you produce, right? Mm-hmm. You're inundated with insurance plans, and you're only dropping 30 points to the bottom line.
Yeah.
Well, I'm producing $550,000 of cash flow per year, and you're producing $300,000 worth of cash flow per year. Mm-hmm. Those practices are not the same.
No, and the one that's, you know, heavily in network is churning through patients. So it's more of a volume game, meaning you're having to see more people to generate that revenue than this practice that's more specialized, right?
So you probably have higher overhead because the more people you see, the more staff you need to see those people.
Mm-hmm.
So your overhead's higher, your profitability's lower. When you're valuing a dental practice, the value is based strictly, and I cannot emphasize this enough, is based strictly off of cash flow. Not revenue. Makes no difference how much you're collecting. It makes 100% difference how much is actually falling to the bottom line in either EBITDA or in seller discretionary earnings.
Cool.
That's the number that we're interested in. So you might even be collecting less than me, $700,000, but you're dropping just as much to the bottom line as I am. Those two practices are worth the same. And if you think about it, if you go to the bank and the bank's looking to finance those two practices, what's the bank looking at to determine how much you can afford to pay for that practice? Cash flow. They don't care about revenue. They care about cash flow. You can't make the note payment to the bank on revenue. You make the note payment to the bank on cash flow, profit.
Mm-hmm.
So that percentage of sales revenue, it's true. If you do a valuation, you can take the purchase price, the calculated value, and divide it by revenue and get a percentage, right? And generally speaking, that percentage right now, national average, is somewhere between 75 and 80%. That's a true statement. But that's just for reference. That's not intended to be used as a valuation formulary. Okay. When you do valuations, there's three different valuation approaches that are accepted under the authoritative bodies that actually rate. I mean, like, valuations are actually regulated in other industries. It's just not really looked at in dentistry. And so part of what I wanted to do when I got involved with all of that is I wanted to standardize that process for our organization across the country so that our valuations were up to standard. And there are organizations out there that do premier valuations, like Blue & Company is an accounting firm out of the Midwest. DDS Match is a seller side transitions broker that do their valuations third party independently through Blue & Company. So cool. I know when I see a valuation come from DDS Match, that valuation isn't skewed to inflate the commission of the broker. Right. And so I have seen valuations like that were very skewed. And I'm like, you got to explain to me how you came up with this number. Because I'm not even close. We're $400,000 off. Right? It's not even close. But there's three valuation methods. One is the asset approach. And that's basically just the adjusted value of net assets. And you're really only going to use that in two cases. One is if you've got a startup you put $650,000 into, you're 3 months in and you're still in the red. There's no cash flow. So based on cash flow, it's insolvent. It's not worth anything. But you've got $650,000 in a build out and in chairs and equipment. So
yeah,
there is
so there's something there. Yeah.
Yeah. So you would use an asset approach there, or you would use an asset approach if you've got a late career practice that's really, been neglected.
Winding down a little, yeah.
And no more cash flow, but there's still a little bit of value in the equipment. You would probably do it there. Otherwise, you're looking at either an income approach or a market approach. The income approach, the process that I tend to prefer is a discounted cash flows. And it's a very complex way of just valuing what the present day value is of the projected cash flows over the next 5 years. I find that it's a little subjective. And I tend to want things to be very objective. And that's why I got into this space to begin with, is because the valuations that I was getting, I was like, well, where'd you come up with that percentage? Like, where did that come from? Like, oh, well, that's just the percentage that we use. Well, that doesn't work.
Why?
I don't know why. Yeah. And so discounted cash flows tends to be a little subjective, but it's more objective, in my opinion, than just pulling a number out of thin air. I also tend to see that based on how well the practice cash flows, the DCF model is going to come in with in my experience, a very strong valuation. So it tends to skew the value up a little bit.
And what is DCF?
Discounted cash flows.
Okay, cool.
Yeah. And it takes various factors into play, like what's the industry growth rate? What's the 10-year treasury? What's the risk-free rate? What's the interest rate? What's the tax bracket? Like, it takes various things into consideration. There's a lot of formulas in it. I have it all in an Excel spreadsheet, so I don't do all of those calculations every time. I just plug in the numbers I need to plug in, and it spits out the number that I'm looking for. So the third approach, which is probably the most common, is the market approach. And this is kind of what people are doing when they take that percentage and apply it to revenue. It's like, what have comparable practices in the last 3 to 5 years traded for in an open market?
Yeah.
Right. Like, if it's $1 million practice and they're selling for $750,000, that's 75%. Right. Let's use that percentage. But when we're looking at multiples, really what we're looking at are multiples of cash flow. So multiples of EBITDA or multiples of seller discretionary earnings. And I want to clarify the difference between those two things, because there's some confusion out there. And it depends on how your accountant sets up your P&L, but like, some practices, the doctors are paying themselves a salary above the line, and then there's profit. And other practices, their P&Ls, everything falls to the bottom line, and the doctors paying themselves off a distribution.
Yep.
Right. So you really need to know what number you're looking at. Seller discretionary earnings is, as an owner operator business, once I add back interest, taxes, depreciation, amortization, and what I paid myself as the owner and as the dentist to do the dentistry, my total earnings from the business. That's seller discretionary earnings. Mm-hmm. But let's say I'm not going to do the dentistry. Let's say I'm going to hire Dr. Jensen to come in and do the dentistry, and I'm just going to be an absentee dentist and collect a paycheck. I've got to pay you to do the dentistry. Mm-hmm. And that's generally somewhere between 20 and 25% of revenue. So once you take that 20 to 25% of revenue out of seller discretionary earnings, what's left over is EBITDA.
Yep.
And so when you look at market valuations, you're looking at, okay, comparable practice collected, you know, somewhere between $1 million and $1.5 million, seller discretionary earnings are 400 to 450, EBITDA is 200, 225. Okay. And I'm going to pull up a list, and there are databases that we use for this. Populate a list, and there'll be 15, 20 practices on there. It will show me all the practices, you know, that have traded, you know, in an open market, that are comparable to the practice that I'm valuing, and what multiples were applied in those transactions. I add all that up. I take the average, and then I kick out any values that are greater, that are more or less than 2 standard deviations from the mean. Okay. Once I kick those out, I calculate the second mean. And then that second mean, that's the average that I use. Okay. So if the multiple, I just recently did a valuation on a multi-location oral surgery practice out of California, and I think their value came in at like 6.45. And it was like they were collecting $3.3 million, and their valuation came in at just under $5 million.
Sweet.
Right. But that's all cash flow. I mean, you're talking about a oral surgery practice. So they're dropping 55 to 60 points at the bottom line. Mm-hmm. Right. Cash flow, what you're valuing. And so I've seen hundreds of thousands of dollars made and lost, you know, at valuations. And so I want to make sure that our clients aren't subject to that stuff. And then once we've done those three valuations, and we know what, you know, we've got kind of a ballpark. So we've done an asset approach. We're not going to use that. We know that. We've done an income approach. We've done a market approach. Then we might take a weighted average of the three. Or we may not even weight the asset approach because we know that's not valid anyway. The value came in at $225,000, and this is a $1.5 million practice, right? We're going to throw that one out. But we'll look at those three values, and then we'll determine from there if we're going to weight it, if we're going to take a raw average. And that's what helps us come to what we call a conclusion of value, which is, this is what we conclude the value of this practice to be.
Now, I want to ask you a question. That was very fascinating. As they were talking, I thought to myself, there are lots of different types of practices that a buyer might be looking to buy, or it might be a good decision or not a good decision to buy. Here's what I mean. Like, new dentist out of school, should the new dentist be looking at this like super GP practice to acquire? Should they be looking for like a fixer upper? You represent a ton of buyers. Do you ever, John, like help them? I don't know this. Do you ever help them like after, cause you do consulting as well. Do you help them after the acquisition to help them like, okay, what do we want to do with this business we're acquiring, and what's our vision for it? And that business could be in all sorts of different places, on its engagement with insurance companies, what type of procedures it's doing. Can you talk us a little bit through that? And then, you know, maybe we'll send that into a wrap up after.
Sure. Yeah. If he's straight out of dental school, and I get calls from a lot of those guys, man, I sponsor a group, and I'm a part of an organization called the Student Dental Business Organization that a couple of clients of mine founded. Cool. And they're in 5 or 6 schools now. It's kind of like an ASDA, but they bring in high powered business oriented resources to speak to the students and prepare them for practice ownership. And when those guys get out of dental school, they're going to have a very hard time securing financing, right? Yeah. Because there's no historical evidence on what they can produce. Okay. Mm-hmm. So if they're straight out of dental school, unless they're an anomaly, and those guys exist. But if they've got mom and dad money, right, or family money, or maybe they were really smart during dental school, they got a lot of liquidity and they can get the financing, that's one thing. But most of them are going to be looking for like a $300,000-$400,000, you know, smaller GP practice. And hopefully the one that they find has a huge upside, a lot of growth synergies in a neglected, you know, dilapidated practice from an old, you know, guy that just hung on too long. But yeah, what I do on the buy side is I'll go in and I'll help them, A, we'll do an independent valuation to validate the value that if the seller has a broker, what they have on the block and see if is that in range and in ballpark. I do to the best of my ability when we've got a broker deal, I do try to protect the value. So we're going to negotiate and all that kind of stuff, but I don't want to come in and just try to cut the legs out from up under the broker.
Yeah.
Right. We'll have a conversation, say, okay, this is where the number's at, and we'll bounce that number back and forth. But I try to protect the interest of all parties. And at the same time, get my buyer the best deal that we can. Sometimes that deal might not be on the purchase price itself. It might be on the conditions and the terms of the APA and the post-closing associates, right? So it may be, we'll give you a higher percentage on the purchase price or a higher, you know, purchase price, but we're going to give you a reduced percentage on the associate commission in your post-closing associate agreement. So there's
a things lot you can of, do, levers you can play. Yeah, that's interesting.
There's so many levers and buttons that you can push and pull there to make deals work. And a lot of folks don't know all the different ways that you can structure that. And so they don't even entertain the idea of the deal. I'm like, you know, I try to create win-win-win solutions, right? So I don't want anybody to lose. I want everybody to come out feeling good about the transaction. But what we do on the from a transition standpoint is just help them understand where the cost synergies are and where the revenue synergies are. Okay. So like cost synergies would be, you know, if they've never renegotiated insurance reimbursements and it's a $1.5 million practice in network with 30 insurance plans, then, you know, we can probably renegotiate those insurance reimbursements and see somewhere between an 18 to a 22% increase in revenue, which is both, you could consider that a revenue synergy because revenue went up, or a cost synergy because it's not costing us as much to acquire patients now. We also look at like overhead line item expenses. Like I think one of the most important numbers in a dental practice is payroll allocation. What percentage of total revenue is allocated to payroll? That tells you so much. It tells you, it gives you insight into the culture, whether the doctor is more supportive or directive in their leadership style, whether we're dealing with entitlement or disempowerment, efficiency, scheduling, tells us a lot about the practice. So I'm looking at all of those variables. I'm looking at your growth synergies, you know, crown to filling ratio, treatment conversion, annual patient value, recare effectiveness. And based on all of that, once this thing closes, doctor, here is the plan in your first 12, 18, 24, 36 months. And here's a pro forma to show you what should happen. Push those buttons and pull those levers. If you want one of our coaches to help implement and facilitate that plan with you over the next few years, that's what our coaches do. Right.
And I'll just make this comment too, because John's not going to say it for himself. One of the cool things, and I think now folks that are listening to the podcast, I've heard this a ton from me. One of the favorite parts of my job is any consultant, a marketing agency, partner of Dental Intelligence, it's got a bunch of clients on with us. I get to go look at global data and then I actually break that down by partners. And when I look at John's portfolio or all of his client base, he consistently outperforms the market in nearly every single metric that matters. So we're talking like the big ones, like annual patient value, their ultimate production, the stuff you guys like to look at, their growth rate in the practice are exceptional. But when we look at retention side, the case side of things, the principles that John is teaching are proven to consistently work across his whole client base. So just so you guys know, when John talks about how he's got a group of people that will come and help, like, it's not just like that situation is not a Wild West situation. It's a proven 20 plus years of experience that he's bringing to the table when he works with practices. So, John, I'll just give you that plug, by the way.
I appreciate that. I wasn't aware. Good to know.
Now, let me ask this. We're kind of at the tail end of this thing. So I want to ask two questions. Maybe one, John, what advice would you give to anyone looking to buy a practice? And then second, we always finish with the question, what does growth in dentistry mean to you? So let's hit those two questions and wrap it up. We might need to do like a longer session on this, like a working session. This is fun.
Yeah. What advice would I give a buyer who's looking to acquire a practice? Global answer, I would say buy the right practice.
Yeah.
absolutely certain you buy the right practice. Be less concerned about where the practice is located and more concerned about the growth potential.
Cool.
Right? Like some of the things that I love to see, and I'll just throw these out there so people know what they are. If you've got a bottlenecked hygiene department, and I can't emphasize this enough. If you've got 3,000 active patients and they're only running 1.5 columns of hygiene, and you can't get a new patient on the schedule for 2 months, and you can't get a recare patient on the schedule for, 18 weeks, and you can't get SRP in for 3 months, that is an absolute bomb waiting to go off. If you just expand hygiene, the amount of restorative that you start converting from the added hygiene volume is going to be extraordinary. That practice could easily double. That's what I would want to do. That's the practice that we want to buy. We want to find the practice that we can buy for $600,000. It's going to be worth $1.5 million in 12 months.
Yep.
Right. That's a home run. So I would look for those things. I would look for practices that, if you place implants and like to do molar endo, and you're really good, and maybe you're a certified partner of, Clear Correct or Sure Smile, and you want to do ortho, and they're not doing ortho, and they're not placing implants. I mean, that's an easy one. If you're doing procedures they're not doing, then that's a home run. That means you're converting more dentistry. That's another very important number: treatment conversion. How many dollars of restorative are you converting to every dollar of hygiene? Another really big one that people don't pay a lot of attention to is crown to filling ratio. And I mean, that one's a critical one, man, because that tells you a lot about a doctor's clinical philosophy. And quite frankly, that's one of the biggest issues that these big DPOs run into, is because they've got doctors on both sides of the proactive, reactive clinical scale. Mm-hmm. And you've got doctors that are contributing more to the profitability of the organization and doctors that aren't. Yep. And that's a recipe for resentment. Right, because we're getting paid the same way. So if your crown to filling ratio is on the higher side, let's say you're spear trained and you're doing 5-6 crowns to every 3 or 4 surface filling that you're doing, and you're buying a practice that's like 1-to-1, that's a home run. Buy that practice every day. So when I'm doing practice acquisition due diligence, I'm looking to see, okay, what kind of provider is buying this practice and what kind of provider is selling this practice. And then once we push that button and transact, what's going to happen afterwards. And I want to make sure that my buyer has a lot of certainty about what's actually going to unfold post acquisition. And what we want to unfold post acquisition is double or triple digit growth, at least in that next 12 to 18 months. Right, but consistently double-digit growth for each year of their career.
And then let's finish. That was for those. I would like, if you have listened to this whole podcast, and then if there's any section I would go back and re-listen to, it's that last little nugget that you just gave us from the advice. Like, that was brilliant. Let's finish with the last question. What does growth in dentistry mean to you, John?
I don't think. You can have industry growth without personal growth. Cool. The philosophy that Fortune takes is, we have a lot of really great systems. We've been doing this for 40 years, right? So we've got really good systems and processes and resources and tools and all that kind of stuff. But at the end of the day, you can have, all the right people with all the wrong systems will still outperform all the wrong people with all the right systems. And so I don't think you can have industry growth without personal growth. And so it's actually a great question, because it speaks to what I feel like my mission in this industry is, which is to, equip practicing dentists with the executive skill set and entrepreneurial mindset to be successful dental enterprise leaders. They acquired a clinical skill set in school, but the only way they're ever going to be able to fully utilize that and benefit from that is to be able to own and operate, a dental business. And so that requires leadership, requires communication. And some of that stuff that needs to be done is uncomfortable. And so, the approach that Fortune takes is we focus on personal growth. You grow the people in the practice will grow as a side effect. And I think if we continue to take that approach, it works very well for us. We get really good results, very happy clients. And but again, that is not for everybody. Some people don't want to grow. They want somebody to come in and fix the problem and then go away, and I stay the same. You know, that's probably not a good fit for us. I don't think you can grow the industry without growing the people. So I think if we continue to focus on personal growth, the people in the practice grows as a side effect, the industry grows as a secondary consequence to that.
Yeah, I love that. Now, John, if there's anyone that wants to get in contact with you, is listening, I'll throw this in the show notes as well. What's the best way to get a hold of you and your team?
My cell is 423-579-3775, and I can pretty much be reached on that 24/7 text or phone call. And then my email is jonharris@fortunemgmt.com.
Sweet. And for those that are driving and don't have the time to catch that, we'll throw both of those, his phone number as well as his email, in the show notes. For sure, reach out to John and his team. I mean, phenomenal people and great partners of Dental Intelligence. Thank you, everyone. Thank you, John, for joining us today. Seriously, thanks for taking the time out of the day to come and do this podcast with us. And thank you to the listeners for joining in. This has been another Growth in Dentistry episode. My name's Steve Jensen, your host. Keep growing.